Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's presentation. For the duration of the conference call, your lines will be on a listen-only mode. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host for today, Evelyn Gansglass. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome to CLASP's call on workforce development, new opportunities for creating pathways to good jobs and sustainable employment. Our speakers today are Sandy Vito, who is Acting Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry, Harry Thomas, Associate Director of the Chicago Jobs Council, and Jason Walsh, who is National Policy Director for Green for All. As the moderator or the operator told you, I believe, the phones are muted for the entire call. But as the instructions that you received yesterday indicated, you're able to ask questions anytime during the call and just send your questions in by email, and we will pose those questions to the speakers at the end of the presentations, at the end of the conversation we have. Just to remind you, that email address is audioconference@clasp.org. So much for our housekeeping, hopefully. So let's move on to the discussion, because I think there's some really interesting issues that we want to bring out during this call. And my first question is really a question to all three of our speakers, and it goes to the multiple expectations that the Recovery Act has placed on the workforce system. It's a great deal of money for a chronically underfunded system. There's tremendous demand for services, people coming into one-stops way beyond the usual level of activity. There are tremendous demands from the President, from Congress, expectations for using the money very quickly, for immediate economic stimulus and as well as long-term economic recovery. It's for helping those who have been long-term unemployed, youth and dislocated workers, those hardest hit by the recession, and also spending the money with very high levels of accountability and transparency. One might suggest that there are some inherent tensions among all of these goals. For example, getting the money out quickly and really changing the way services are being delivered. I'd like to ask each of you, just as an opening shot, what do you think the ultimate measures of success for the workforce should be under the Recovery Act? And why don't we start with Sandy?
I think that the ultimate measures of success will be sort of a twofold set of goals. One, do we put people to work? And seems simple, but in this economy it's challenging. But two, how transformational is the new money in building, improving a system that works to build the skills of people who potentially can take advantage of job opportunities when the economy does recover? So that means that the system's going to be judged by how much of the funds actually go into training, how much of it serves people who are not just recently unemployed but who have been outside of the labor market, and how much of it is targeted to real skill development and career pathways.
Sounds like a challenge to me. Harry, what do you think the ultimate goal should be?
Well, similar to Sandy, I think an ultimate measure of success is whether we've used this opportunity to build skills in the workforce, specifically whether we've helped people who languish in low-wage, low-skill jobs or people who haven't had the marketable skills to get or keep a decent job. But I also think another measure of success should be the extent to which the workforce education and training that gets paid for is connected to the industries that other parts of the recovery package are intended to create jobs in, so whether we really are linking our workforce and economic development strategies.
Jason?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with what both Sandy and Carrie said. All I'll add is that I think they're going to be both programmatic measures of success, and then larger measures of success with respect to the legislation itself, and then political measures of success, if I can use that term. So, I mean, to be clear, there is particular language within the Recovery Act that is specific to particular pots of money, right? So, under the Workforce Investment Act adult program, the Recovery Act specifies that priority be given for both intensive and training services to public assistance recipients and other low-income individuals. So obviously a programmatic measure of success is the degree to which local workforce investment boards can actually serve those populations. There is a larger, I think, measure of success with respect to the Recovery Act, which really speaks to its purposes. The Recovery Act lists five overall purposes, which I won't go through. I won't go through all five, but the fourth is helping those most impacted by the recession, which I think speaks directly to being able to serve effectively both the recently dislocated and the long-term unemployed. I'll echo what Kerry said in that I think Congress in particular is going to be looking closely at the extent to which and the effectiveness with which the local workforce system can train workers for the jobs created by the Recovery Act. And then just a final point, which, you know, and maybe this is stating the obvious, but I'll state it anyway. I mean, I think folks within the workforce education system need to recognize, I think most of them do, that the Recovery Act is deeply politicized, and its implementation will be closely watched. And many of those watching aren't particularly interested in seeing it succeed. In fact, want to see it fail. Because if it is implemented well and effectively, and if the narrative that develops around that implementation tells a story about the effectiveness of public programs, obviously that has enormous consequences for our future ability to reinvest in the public workforce system, or any of our public systems that have been disinvested in over the last 8 years, and plus in many cases. The converse, of course, is that if implementation is perceived to have failed, then there's no way in hell we're going to be able to make a case that there be future investments in these programs, whether in a stimulus part two or in the appropriations process. So, I mean, I really do think this is going to be a referendum on the effectiveness of activist government. And I think the key takeaway for those of us who care about this system is that we are going to face a level of scrutiny far above and beyond, you know, a DOL audit. There's a lot on the line here, and I think policymakers and opinion makers and the public are going to be watching closely to see whether these new funds are being used to do work in new and innovative and, as Sandy said, transformative ways.
And that's exactly what we want to highlight in this call, some ideas, some lessons that have been learned from exemplary kinds of programs to provide some guidance to the field as people start thinking about how to deliver services to populations that have really been underserved in recent years through the workforce system. Kerry, what advice would you give local workforce boards regarding the kinds of training and service delivery models that work best for low-income, low-skill populations? And how could they use the broader contracting authority that's come through the Recovery Act to procure those services?
Well, one thing I'd like to say, that a piece of advice that I heard last week that I actually think is something maybe some of us haven't thought of, and I know the workforce system works very differently in different parts of the country and even in different parts of each state. But in some places, the Workforce Investment Act services have not been that accessible to the lowest income or the people or the most disadvantaged people who are trying to get into the labor market. So It might be important simply to get the word out that there are increases in services and there is more money. And I don't think we should assume that because the Recovery Act has gotten so much press and there's been so much discussion in our worlds about it that everybody knows that. And I think one of the ways to do that is to look to some of the social service and community-based organizations that are seeing increases of numbers of people looking for services like food shelves and community action programs and housing providers. So I would just say that as a threshold, is that getting the word out that there's more services is going to make a difference about whether you can serve the people the Act was intended to and whether you can do that quickly. But second, I think in terms of program models, I think that to the extent allowed under the Workforce Investment Act, I think that we should be looking at ways to combine paid work with skills training. So, for example, this is a good opportunity to figure out how to build off of the many pilots and demonstration projects around transitional jobs for hard-to-employ people, and thinking about how this funding and these new resources could help build skill-building components into those, could connect transitional jobs programs to maybe bridge programs, to other occupational skills training models. And it isn't just increased funding that creates this opportunity, but it's sort of the economic situation that we're in. This is really a good approach because it's a way to provide paid employment when unemployment is high. So it puts money in people's pockets that they're likely to spend. And in addition, it's, you know, usually thinking about skill building in relation to work. So, you know, work-based learning is really more effective for a lot of people who haven't succeeded in traditional education settings. And it's not just transitional jobs that's a model. I mean, there's other types of models that use paid employment, so on-the-job training, paid internships, work stipends, partially subsidizing jobs. They can be tailored to different populations. So I think the point is to give people paid work experience and skill building at the same time. I think also that allowance for contracting for training might be an opportunity for community colleges and other training providers to customize a course of study or a credentialed program to the needs of maybe a cohort of lower-income people. So customize both in the, you know, when it's offered or how the, you know, how the hours go so that it kind of accommodates people's family care or maybe if they have part-time work. Also thinking about support services and other things that go along with that.
That's really interesting. I mean, you've talked about combining work and education in a variety of ways, doing much more cohort training than before, support services. One of the program elements that was mentioned in the Recovery Act in the colloquy between Senators Harkin and Murray was also needs-related payments. What role do you see for needs-related payments in the system? It's something that really hasn't been used much at all in recent years.
Well, I think that people are really attuned to that because it was pointed out in the legislation, and they haven't, I mean, what we have heard locally is that, yeah, nobody's been able to use that opportunity in the Workforce Investment Act because there hasn't been enough money and because of the charge that we as services should be universally accessible, so people have worried more about that. So I think the role that it plays is really thinking about this population that really struggles to stay in training programs and often is, you know, one economic crisis to another. So really thinking about having needs-related payments as part of the sort of support services tools that you might have. People need income support at times when, you know, you don't expect it, and needs-related payments would be one way to do that.
Sandy, what is it that the state could be doing or states could be doing to promote greater attention to low-income, low-skill populations and to help the local delivery areas actually structure programs that are likely to succeed with this population?
I think a lot, so let me just be brief on each of them and then allow for questions later if anybody wants expanded explanation. First, the Workforce Investment Act itself says that in prioritizing services for low-income and individuals receiving public assistance, the state or the governor can put out guidance. So taking advantage of that opportunity to put out guidance and be very clear about priorities. Second, looking at, I'm going to call it triple enrollment, so that we're specifically looking at TANF clients, people who may be receiving food stamps but not receiving TANF, and how can we enroll, have folks enrolled in TANF, in WIA, and in literacy programs. So that's another way that the state can sort of break down barriers to provide seamless service to individuals in communities. Again, just want to support the notion of transitional work or paid work. The needs-related payments, I think, will help create more transitional work opportunities. Obviously, combining education and literacy occupational and education literacy training. I also want to mention that taking advantage of apprenticeship programs and building strong pre-apprenticeship programs will be significant for folks currently outside of the labor force. One of the things that we're looking at is linking on the job creation side, so any of the road money that will be let out through RFP, putting specific language in that gives preference to people who hire from among the unemployed, from at-risk youth populations, and from folks who have traditionally are either low income or receiving assistance.
That's great. You know, there's been very little co-enrollment, let's say, between Title I, Title II of WIA, or or TANF recipients being served. What is it that has been the problem up until now?
It's
state and local level. What could be done to really facilitate the linkage between these programs?
It really is the reporting guidelines on the TANF side that I think are among the biggest barriers. What we hear from the locals and from the community colleges is they don't track time and attendance of their enrollees. So that's the barrier that has to be overcome, and one of the things that we're looking at, well, how can we ensure that TANF clients have the same opportunities as other clients but still meet those federal guidelines? And, you know, we're hopeful that perhaps there might be some relaxing of those rules down the line.
Sorry, do you have any thoughts about that from the local perspective?
Well, it will differ in different parts of the country, but I know locally we're actually hoping that we do something that might be kind of obvious, which is to look at the vendors and contractors and see if there are any that have contracts in both systems, and maybe thinking about ways that we already should be coordinated locally, and we just haven't thought about that as a system, but especially between the Title I and the Title II contractors. I think the other thing is just to figure out ways to incent that or require some kind of partnership, as, you know, if contracts increase with increased funding or there's new RFPs that go out with increased funding. I also think that it's time to build on from what works well. So a lot of innovation has happened in this time of limited funding, where people have put together different pieces. So I think looking at this increased funding in the Workforce Investment Act and all the ways that it could have possibly been used and can be now, and thinking about where the gaps have been in some initiatives. So if you've had sector or career pathways initiatives that have really focused on people who could already, who have some basic skills, maybe now it's time to build the basic skills piece onto it. So like the bridge program or even a pre-bridge program in some cases. I also think supporting people who haven't been able to participate in some of those sector projects or pathways projects because they are very low income. So thinking about the support services that are needed, not just in terms of academic support, but in terms of income support, so thinking more broadly about support services. So people on the workforce investment side or the TANF side think about support as income support or childcare or transportation, whereas people in education often think of support services as the support services that students need. But how about thinking about those together in one package and sort of making sure that all of those things can be funded?
And, Carrie, you mentioned, you know, innovative programs. One of the innovations I think that we're learning really works well is to not think of basic skills and occupational training in a sequential way, where first you go through basic skills remediation or English language instruction, and then at a later point you really start the occupational training that helps you get the job, but really to integrate those in a concurrent way, either in the same classroom or at least not in a sequential way that just takes much longer. The success has been much higher with those kinds of programs, and people are able to get to credentials that really have value in the labor market, because so often people just drop out of programs when it just takes too long to go one step at a time. Maybe we can get back to that later on. I'd like to turn to Jason. You know, there's been a lot more money put through the system through the formula funding streams, but there's also been increased funding for discretionary programs, both in the Dislocator Workers National Reserve, as well as training programs in high-growth emerging industry sectors such as energy efficiency and renewable energy and healthcare. While the Secretary is not obligated, as I understand it, to implement all of the provisions of the Green Jobs Act, it's highly likely, given her support for the Green Jobs Act when it was first introduced, that much of the Green Jobs Act would be included in DOL's guidance and implementation of this component of the program. Jason, I know you've been involved in this since the beginning. What's your understanding of where DOL might be going with implementation of the, I'll label them green jobs provisions, and what are some of the opportunities that provides?
Yeah, well, the obvious caveat is that I won't claim to speak for DOL, but it is worth noting that the now confirmed secretary, after a ridiculously long process, it was not just a supporter of the Green Jobs Act, it was actually the chief sponsor in the House. So I think it is safe to assume that she will want to see this grant program implemented in the spirit of that legislation. I mean, there were some reasons why this grant program was not run through the statute, through the authorized program, mostly because when that legislation was developed, it was not intended to move $500 million very, very quickly. It actually sets up four separate competitive grant programs. This language in the Recovery Act gives the Secretary broad discretion on doing a whole bunch of different competitive grant programs, which I suspect you will not, given the urgency here, or even one that seeks to fund a range of the projects specified in the Green Jobs Act, ranging from research to labor exchange to actual job training projects. It's worth noting a few things. Even though it doesn't run through the statute, it does target populations that are identified as priority as target populations within the Green Jobs Act, and so that includes unemployed individuals, at-risk youth, ex-offenders, and it also specifies that the industries that are identified in the Green Jobs Act, which are a range of renewable energy and energy efficiency industries. You know, it's also worth noting, I think, that the Green Jobs Act relies heavily on partnerships at the local level. And so as folks prepare for this money, they should start thinking about what kind of partnerships are going to be in a position to draw down this money. Those partnerships should include both industry and organized labor, where it's appropriate. They should include the workforce system, educational institutions, community organizations. There's a very strong emphasis within the Green Jobs Act, and thus I think it will be there within this new grant program on pathways out of poverty. And into not only jobs but careers in renewable energy and energy efficiency industries. I think it's worth noting, given the mention of career pathways, that that the language within the Green Jobs Act is very much consistent with the career pathways model on the pathways out of poverty piece. It is looking for training partnerships that integrate basic education and occupational training, that incorporate training and wraparound support services that deliver their programs in formats and at places and at times that are accessible to working adults. I think a very good way to prepare for this grant program is to look closely at the Green Jobs Act, because I think it'll give us a pretty good indication of how this is going to be rolled out.
What kinds of jobs are actually going to be created? What kinds of green jobs are actually going to be created? Which agencies are going to be responsible for doing that? And how might the workforce system connect to, at both the state and at the local level, to the various decision makers on the job creation side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I think the Recovery Act provides us with the opportunity to dispel some misconceptions about green jobs. The first is that green jobs are out there somewhere in the sci-fi future, when in fact they're mostly right in front of us. Building a green economy will require some brand new industries and some brand new occupations, but for the most part it will require transforming the industries and occupations we already have. I think the second very related misconception is that it will only be a handful of scientists and engineers who build this, and those are going to be the green jobs, when in fact most of the work is going to be done by pipe fitters and electricians and carpenters and mechanics and welders and technicians, folks in a range of middle-skill jobs that require more than a high school education but less than a four-year college degree. And these are the most of the jobs that are going to be created by the Recovery Act funds. There is an enormous amount of investment in clean energy programs within the Recovery Act to the tune of about $71 billion. There's also an additional $20 billion in clean energy tax incentives. Most of the renewable energy jobs will be in manufacturing and in installation and maintenance. Most of the energy efficiency jobs created will be in the building trades, and then a subsector of that will be in occupations that are very specific to energy efficiency, like energy auditors. I think in preparing for these jobs and in the response of local systems, it's worth recognizing that particular industries are going to be stimulated more so than others by Recovery Act funds. I think local leaders are really going to need to identify those sectors and identify the strategies that are going to be necessary so that the people who most need work in communities are prepared to do this work and prepared for the jobs that are created by the Recovery Act. I also think there's a danger here of siloing, both at the local and state level. It's going to be particularly important for local leaders, state leaders, to put in place mechanisms that ensure the linkage between programs that create jobs and those that train people for jobs. It's going to be, I think, particularly important because a lot of the job creation is going to run through programs, and this varies, of course, from state to state, but programs that are administered by departments of transportation and departments of energy. The extent to which those departments at the state level talk to and work with state departments of labor is inconsistent across the country. Given that these agencies are not working together as a matter of course, that's going to need to change. Then at the local level, I think this is a moment that is tailor made for sectoral employment strategies, and Pennsylvania has been one of the leaders in that regard. So I'll let Sandy talk more about that.
Thank you. You just did my segue. That's exactly how I wanted to do that. Sandy, really, you have Pennsylvania is known as one of the states that has really done the most in the sectoral workforce strategy arena. Can you talk a little bit about the lessons that you've learned from that sector approach and how that has prepared you to take on this challenge of linking to job creation in the green jobs energy sector, but manufacturing and construction in other sectors as well?
You know, the lessons that we learned in large part follow the outline of the Green Jobs Act. The first piece I want to really put a lot of emphasis on is by bringing together the employers and the unions, we have real-time data on what the jobs are, where there are actual right now job shortages in energy, as well as in healthcare. So it makes the labor market more transparent. So I can't underscore strongly enough how important that piece of it. The second piece is that these partnerships have become expert, really, in creating the career pathways that we all seek to create. What our experience was before we had our industry partnerships is that folks talked about career pathways, but they talked about it on the education side. So there was a clear educational pathway that did not match the actual industry pathway. So let me just kind of give you an example. In our energy, in one of our energy partnerships, they are in the process of developing a career pathway that works on weatherization and energy auditing in the residential area, but then looks at upskilling those folks to get them into the commercial area where the jobs pay more, et cetera. It also has made, we just put out, and this refers back to an earlier question you asked, how can we use, states use their discretionary money? We're using our existing discretionary money for reemployment grants that will focus on cohort training. That cohort training makes more sense because the industry partnerships can tell us, well, we need lots of folks to do weatherization and solar installation right now, before even the stimulus money comes out. We need respiratory therapists in healthcare. So it's very much linked to getting folks into the labor market who've either recently left and or have had have been out longer. The other thing I just want to talk about that relates to the partnerships and the career pathway strategies within the partnerships is that we've also found that career coaching is an important element in the success of helping people move along the career pathway. So it's an important piece that we can, that people can use some of the supportive services to help folks, particularly those who may not have been in the labor market most recently. Third point, the creation of these has required a lot of technical assistance and peer learning. So one of the roles that the state and local areas can play is working with each other to understand what changes in the industry have happened and also what strategies have worked. And then finally, I think it's very important that the partnerships also look at the question of sustainability. So, for instance, I just want to give you one notion of success. We had a healthcare partnership for direct care workers where the wages were able to be negotiated in such a way that after the training, individuals got more money, and then in addition to that, the union and the employer created a job training. That was part of the contract negotiation, and that started because we were able to create that partnership. That's crucial because as we're learning more and more about this economic climate, the job quality issue is going to become, I think, more central to the discussion. Yes, we need to upskill and get more folks into those middle-skilled jobs, but there are jobs at the lower end of the labor market that, in which, where the job quality needs to be improved, and the partnerships provide the opportunity to create both the career pathways but also to improve the human resource practice within the industry.
So, Sandy, you talked about weatherization and using weatherization as a starting point and then helping people move on to residential construction where wages are higher. I've heard a lot of discussion about poor job quality on the weatherization side. Jason, do you have any thoughts about what can be done in that area since it's such a big chunk of the recovery activity?
Yeah, well, I mean, Sandy's describing exactly what can be done, and I hope more states and local areas imitate that. I mean, first of all, folks need to recognize that, and this is a larger point, that there are resources for training beyond the Workforce Investment Act funds that flow down, right? So within the Weatherization Assistance Program, which, by the way, has been running as a more or less $220, $230 million program for the last several years, it now has $5 billion, right? And up to 20% of that, so think $1 billion. Just to put that in perspective, double the adult funding stream under WEA in the Recovery Act can be allocated for training and technical assistance. Which is going to be really crucial. But a number of questions need to be asked and need to be answered. Will the expansion of the program be used to connect what is typically shorter-term training necessary for residential weatherization to a true career pathway that leads to a higher level, often union job in the more skill-intensive commercial building retrofit industry? Will the dramatic increase of funds for the program be used to increase the quality and pay of the jobs within the residential weatherization industry and to catalyze the participation of contractors who pay family-sustaining wages and benefits? I mean, I think this is going to be one of the key implementation questions to address here over the next few months, and it's going to require community action agencies, which are typically the recipients of these funds, and the building trades and the public system and employers to work together in a way they haven't before.
Evelyn, can I just add something to that?
Sure, go ahead.
One of the things that we did, and this is pre-getting the stimulus money, but we're in the process of, with our weatherization unit and our discretionary WEA dollars, putting out, and again, it doesn't have to be this much. Remember, Pennsylvania is a big state, but we're just starting right now with a $2 million pot of money for weatherization training, hoping that pot will obviously grow with additional weatherization training. But the point of that was to link those two sources of money so that we can build in the career pathways that Jason and I both talked about, and also work with the weatherization folks who are doing the weatherization to get their workforce needs met, but all link in around the job quality issue again. So it's leveraging those resources that I think is going to be really useful, and a lot of leadership needs to come from the states on that.
And there have been some local workforce investment boards that even before the Recovery Act money have really tried to use training and employment services to work with, quote, high road employers and to try to really become part of a good job strategy. So I think it's building on those successes. Let me, before opening it up to others, I just wanted to ask a pretty mundane question. But given the sectoral partnerships that have existed, given all of the work that's been done in the green jobs arena, are there curricula and programs available that other communities that really haven't gotten into this as much as some could use quickly? Is there a way of sharing among communities this information? I'm opening it up to any of you on that.
My sense is I would not, if I were a local area, I would not right now pay for any curriculum development until I did some research about what was out there. So, for instance, in Pennsylvania, we do have curriculum developed in all of the programs that in all of the energy areas and in the healthcare areas we just discussed. It's an information asymmetry. It's not a lack of existing curricula.
Curricula is being delivered through
Through whom? Through community colleges, community-based organizations, variety of organizations. How is this working in Pennsylvania?
Some combination. In some cases, it's community colleges. In energy, for instance, we have what's called the Energy Coordinating Agency in Southeast Pennsylvania, and they have a very, very good curricula to the weatherization standards and the energy auditing standards that are required in the industry. And that's a community-based organization.
Let me go back to a point that came up earlier, and that was about cohort training. One of the issues that I have heard talk about is lack of recent experience in the whole procurement process because of the use of ITAs and just inexperience in really negotiating for contract training. Any of you who've been involved with this, Carrie at the local level or Sandy at the state, do you have any guidance or suggestions for other communities or states on this whole question of contracting and procurement, especially given the speed with which everything has to happen?
I don't. Locally, ITAs are the way that it has happened for the most part, and I think the procurement issues differ, so I don't have any advice at this point.
Sandy, you've talked about really trying to promote cohort training, which does include clearly procurement. Is that an issue that you have had to deal with in Pennsylvania, or do you think that that's really not a big a problem as some have suggested?
What we're doing is an expedited competitive grant-making process. So it's not necessarily the contracting process, which is in state and procurement speak a longer process, but it is a competitive grant-making process, and I think the importance of that is not only to meet whatever procurement codes exist within the local areas and the states, but also to make sure that you're getting what you pay for. You know, a cohort training will not be, equal. Some, for instance, community colleges, and we've challenged our community colleges, are starting enrollment, not just by semester and in emerging occupations. That's clearly the kind of cohort training we want. We don't just want sort of training for the sake of it. We want to look at the strong outcomes in the occupation, so that competitive process gives you the opportunity. Without knowing what the barriers are on the procurement side, I'm not sure I can address the specific questions, but maybe people will have questions.
I know a number of questions have come in, so let's turn to some of the questions that we've received so far. Matt, do you want to tell us what those are?
Sure. The first question probably applies to WEA reauthorization as well as the Recovery Act. And it's, will WEA be rewritten so that it allows new models for training with contracts and cohort group training?
And the answer to that is?
I don't think we know.
That we will try our hardest to make that happen in the WEA reauthorization process.
I think clearly there is going to be an opportunity to increase within WEA the capacity that does not exist there now unless state and local leaders, as in Pennsylvania, use their money creatively and actually use state money as well. That there will be some added, hopefully, capacity for sectoral approaches to some of this work. We've got legislation out there from Senator Snow and Senator Brown that I think lays this out in a pretty explicit way. But there will be it's hard to talk about WEA reauthorization and to take that seriously given how long it hasn't been reauthorized, but I suspect we'll have an actual shot at it this year.
I think it's a good sign what happened in the Recovery Act that it'll be taken seriously.
And the Recovery Act really does provide an opportunity to test out some of these strategies at a larger scale throughout the system and to make use of the tools that are available. Matt, was there another question as well?
This is the last one. This person was concerned that service providers are going to focus on job placement outcomes while the job creation efforts are being kicked into gear. So how can we create interim benchmarks like attaining skill credentials while we're waiting for sufficient jobs to be created? Does that make sense?
Are there any thoughts about that, how one can measure movement towards employment, attainment of credentials within the system?
I think it does make sense. I think the question is, since the Workforce Investment Act performance measures didn't change at all, the question is will there be anything from DOL about how to look at that and whether that will change.
Well, let me ask Sandy in particular, but others as well. Have you given thought to the whole issue of transparency throughout Recovery Act, but particularly for the workforce programs, and whether it makes sense even outside the performance standards process and measures that we have for individual states or perhaps nationally, if that could be arranged, to develop some other measures or other benchmarks that could be used to communicate success of the system, going right back to the first question about expectations and the tremendous transparency that's being expected of the system.
Evelyn, let me say two things. Let me answer the last question first. I think the expectation among members of Congress is that this money will be used for training, so credentials will matter. I think the second question is the transparency, and given the performance measures, how do we report that? But, it's the credential and then the job afterwards. So given the opportunity we have in that so many people have longer unemployment benefits, I think that this money can be directed by both states and local areas to training, or at least a large portion of it, without really jeopardizing the performance measures, even as they're written. On the transparency issue, I'll say this. We've thought about it. The state is going to have its own website, which then I think will somehow link that information to the federal website. We haven't gotten through all of what that means yet, but a couple of key things we do know. There's a real call for public input. So we recently had a state workforce investment board meeting. We're encouraging and I think going to require all of our local investment boards to hold a public meeting asking for input about the job training money. I think that's a very important public engagement piece. And then we are in the process of developing systems that would track this information independently and produce it and put it on the state website and then make it available to the federal government. I don't think we've worked out all those details, nor do I believe that DOL, just based on a phone call I had, has figured out exactly how they want us to track it either.
The only thing I would add to that is I think it's particularly important to note for advocates of low-income folks that, and again, I'll say the obvious, but because the majority of Recovery Act dollars are flowing really, really quickly, there is significant danger of pet project funding, deal cutting that are not going to benefit communities most in need, and that advocates really should be pushing for public hearings, citizen oversight boards, other mechanisms to make decision-making transparent and to create forums where democratic voices can be heard. I think that's going to be really key. There are examples of coalitions that have formed in different parts of the country to make sure that happens. I think we also have the ability to point directly at the legislation itself that is, with respect to WEA, prioritizing that these funds be used to target low-income individuals. And, of course, one of the stories of WEA over the last many years is that we have seen a shift away from serving those most in need as the system has to shift to a more universal customer. Obviously, we need to still serve that universal customer, but there is particular attention within this legislation to serving those who are low income and on public assistance. And advocates, where policymakers are not as progressive as we would like, unlike in Pennsylvania, that advocates and practitioners, for that matter, really need to hold folks accountable.
I would just add, this is Evelyn, that prior to the call, we sent out principles for state implementation of the Recovery Act that the Working Poor Family Project and a whole group of organizations, including CLASP, developed that talk specifically about transparency, that talk about targeting those most in need, investing in services. So I urge you to look at those principles and to really use them in your work, whether you're within the system or outside as an advocate, to guide some of the decision-making and to share with people at the levels at which you are working, because I think they very much reflect the best thinking about expectations for the system and the outcomes we're trying to achieve. I believe another question has come in.
Yeah. Question is about how to connect formerly incarcerated individuals with the programs that are being funded with the Recovery Act. Is there any interaction with the new programs the Second Chance Act has created, and is DOL releasing any information for how to bridge those programs? If you could just speak generally about how formerly incarcerated people could be connected with job opportunities and skills training.
Well, I mean, let's keep in mind that DOL just got a secretary confirmed last week. So, there's a bunch of guidance that has not come out yet that will come out. The Second Chance Act was not funded within the Recovery Act. The green jobs, the $500 million for green jobs training, as I mentioned before, does target populations that are identified and specified within the Green Jobs Act. Ex-offenders are one of those. So that's a pot of money that folks looking to target ex-offender populations should be looking at particularly closely.
Any other thoughts about that? Let me just add that Carrie mentioned early on in the call transitional jobs, and transitional jobs have been used quite extensively with the reentry population, and are the kind of model that combines work and skill enhancement and basically paid work experience. More than paid work experience, it's actually paid employment, but on a transitional basis. So that is a model that very much fits this population and can be used as in the early stages of helping people transition into unsubsidized paid employment.
And it's a strategy that's identified in the Green Jobs Act. And although it's not running through the statute per se, as I said earlier, I think we should look at that legislation to get a good sense of what DOL will be looking for.
The only thing I would add is that there are particular industries in which ex-offenders fare better, and building and construction is one of them. So I think that there will, because of the job creation activities in the Recovery Act, be more opportunities for those clients of ours. Healthcare, for instance, is not a great area. Ex-offenders tend not to do very well in that sector of the economy.
Let me, we are just about out of time. Let me just mention that we have a number of calls coming up, and one of the ones coming up is actually on transitional jobs. That audio call is scheduled for March 18th. There's also one on rebuilding the safety net that is scheduled for March 11th, and then on March 25th, one on new opportunities for serving older youth. CLASP is a founding member of the National Transitional Jobs Network, and for the person who asked about models for serving people coming out of prisons, we'd be happy to follow up with you and give you some examples and some contacts on transitional jobs and that population. So thank you all for participating. I urge you to take part in additional audio calls that we've set up, and to look at the CLASP website, www.clasp.org, for background material on a lot of the points that we've been discussing on the call. Thank you, Sandy, Carrie, and Jason.
Thank you, everybody.